Good evening, everybody. James McKenney here with my Science Hour. This is for May 25th, 2023. Tonight, as promised, I'm going to be talking about the powers of two. Very interesting topic when it comes to population growth and population growth in the world. And this is a topic that is kind of making the news, but I have a twist on it that you're not going to hear anyplace else. People have been talking, I've seen this, a number of people talking about population in the world. And some people say, oh, it's going down, there's a crisis in the world, there's not enough people. But it depends on where you look. I saw one woman, she was talking about North and South Korea, a very stark example, where you have a very economically successful South Korea as opposed to an extremely restrictive communist country in the North, North Korea. But the population in South Korea is losing. It's a 0.78, it was said. That's a quote from another source. In other words, they are losing population, and it takes a reproduction rate of two. In other words, mother, father, having two children, that would then maintain the population, given a normal longevity of the people. And so, in other words, if the people had two children, then those two children would get married and each would have two children. So 2.0 is the number in terms of population offspring that would maintain the population at exactly the same amount. South Korea has 0.78, which means that couples are not even having, on the average, one child. And so that's what happens in an economy that is succeeding, that is very prosperous. In North Korea, under very strict communist rule, interestingly enough, and you find this also in China, North Korean population is booming, and they are growing by a considerable amount. In fact, it is, and this is one of the fears. This goes back to the Middle Ages, the kind of the wars. Remember the Crusades between the Catholics from the Vatican, from Rome, centered in Rome, and the so-called Holy Lands, where the Crusades, the soldiers volunteered to go down to the Holy Lands to win back the Holy Lands, and actually, it didn't turn out too good for the Crusaders. A lot of them were killed, captured, etc. But one of the big fears was that the Arab populations would outpopulate the Catholic population. So one of the issues was no birth control, have as many babies as you can, not as many as you want, but simply as many as you can to maintain the population for fear that the other religion would overtake. And not overtakes only in numbers, but be able to conquer you. And that's the fear also of North Korea becoming such a populous country that the South could not defend itself. Well, of course, with modern-day warfare equipment, you can have one person equal many. But then again, you get into nuclear weapons, and that changes the entire numbers game. But on a physical basis, man-to-man fighting, they're afraid that North Korea would simply outpopulate South Korea, and that is actually what's going on. So you have countries like South Korea, North Korea, that are right next to each other that are having totally different population results. So it turns out when you have economically successful populations, the populations tend to decrease. Not only decrease, but decrease dramatically because people have more money, they have more time to do things like go on vacation, there's much less incentive to go out and have babies right away, you look in third world countries like Latin America, where if you're a little girl, 15 years old, and you don't have a baby yet, it's just unusual. And so there's a lot of babies born out of wedlock in Latin America. And then maybe sometimes the guy will stick around, and once they have two or three kids, then they get married. And that's very common in Latin America. Or the girl never has a husband at all, and she just goes from boyfriend to boyfriend, etc., maybe for the rest of her life. But trying to raise kids, and that's where the family comes in, because a 15-year-old girl has no money, doesn't have a job. So these little babies are being raised by the extended family. Could be an aunt, could be the mother and father. It could be a group of family members who all kind of pitch in to raise this girl. And then these girls become mothers at a very young age, which puts them in a situation that before 30, they are grandmothers. And so that's very common in Latin American countries where the populations are growing. And so anyway, this gets into the whole discussion of population growth. And I brought this up originally a couple of weeks ago, and I've been on other radio shows as guests talking about this. And I talk about the power of two, and it goes like this. That in a... let's take a third world country where you have a mortality rate of 50% before age 10. In other words, 50% of the kids, the babies, the children, die before age 10. That's the mortality rate. It's incredible. But even with that, they have a 7% growth rate per year. And so in these countries, if you have a 7% per year growth rate, compound interest, do that over a period of 10 years, and you double the population of the country in 10 years. This is what's going on. And this is why nobody talks about this, because our senators, our congressmen, presidents, whoever, are not intelligent enough to do the math, very simple math, that if you are accepting these people as illegal immigrants into your country, the simple fact is people go, oh, well, we're helping them out. The simple fact is those countries are not losing any population. You think, oh, a lot of people are coming here from, say, Mexico or other Latin American countries, and so their populations are being depleted, and that is not correct, because they can, every 10 years, they reproduce their entire population. So Mexico has a population of 104 million. It's the most populous of all the Latin American countries. Even with a mortality rate of 50% before age 10, they're still doubling their population every 10 years. That population is coming into the United States. So that puts 100 million people into the United States every 10 years. The United States population without illegal immigration would be at around 270 million right now and falling. The way it is now, it's around 370 million, add another 100 million easily. And right now, over the last 2 years, there have been 10 million more added to the population. And the point is that people go, oh, those people are seeking asylum or a better life. Well, of course they're seeking a better life, you know, because they come from a country where it's just crap and there's no opportunity, etc. But there's a lot of those people are criminals, hardened criminals, because of living on a street in a third world country, being raised without a father, being raised without a home, and learning to steal at age 10 or younger. Okay, so anyway, but the point is not talking about social conditions or anything else. I'm simply talking about population. The point is that those countries are not losing any population, and they can continue to send 10 million people collectively every year, every 2 years, without their country losing any population at all. So now let's look at the power of two. If you are doubling your country's population every 10 years, then do that over a period of 100 years, you get a multiplication factor of 1,000. In other words, over a period of 100 years, you can go from 1 million people, take a population of 1 million people, to 1 billion people. That is what's going on right now. So the United States, with I'll just mention this other little fun fact, that people go, oh my goodness, there's 10 million more people in the United States now than there were 2 years ago. They want to put 100 to 500 million people, illegal aliens, in the United States. That's the plan. Now, if you look at the Communist Manifesto, this is the Communist Manifesto at work. To import people from another country, and you can look at the Ukraine, you can look at Russia. That's what happened with Russia. There were a lot of people that came from other countries into Russia before the revolution. The early 1900s Bolshevik-Menshevik revolution, where they killed the Tsar, and you know the whole story. Or you can look in the Ukraine, where they brought in Russian immigrants into the Ukraine and replaced the people that were on the farms. And then those people were very successful small farmers. They were small farms, very successful, produced a tremendous amount of food. They get rid of them. They throw them off their land and bring in these other people that don't know what they're doing, and everybody starves to death. But the communists are able to take over. They're able to put their, you know, they take the kids out of the house, put them in public schools, and then don't teach them anything except the party line. Don't teach them history, and that's what's going on today. We have probably into our fourth generation now of people who don't know anything except buzzwords like race. Everything is race. Everything is gender identity. All of these things that are coming in are all part of the Communist Manifesto. These are in the, just read it. That's what it says. And the idea is to divisively divide people into groups. Fund the police, defund the police. Black, white, race, gender, economic status, rich, poor, skin color, whatever it is, divide the people. Cause diversity, and that's what when you hear the terms diversity and inclusiveness, those are divisive words that are used in a very cunning way to fool people into buying into the Communist Manifesto. That's what's going on in the United States. And I saw an interesting thing the other day where a guy wrote some books, and he's saying that whenever one of the great empires in history was about to crumble, the very last stage was diversity of gender. That was the very last thing that came in, and then the curtain fell on that empire, where it just disintegrated from within. And that's what's going on in the United States right now. You see counties getting away from states. You see the big cities controlling the entire state. And you can look at almost any state. There's one big city, or maybe two, that control all of the politics in the entire state. And the people living out in the countryside have no say at all, where things tend to be more conservative. But back to the population of growth, the number, the power of two, as I'm calling it. Okay, so if you take, and this is where this originally started, I was talking about archaeology and natural disaster. So say there was a worldwide natural disaster and you had 1,000 people. left over. And the reason I take 1,000 people is because that's a genetically diverse pool that can reproduce without inbreeding. If you get too many family members that are too close and they're having children, then it doesn't work. Genetically, it does not work. And by the way, interestingly enough, that was the failure of Hitler's Aryan race, where they wanted to concentrate on the Aryan, the white skin, blue hair, blonde hair, blue eyed, physically very fit, the what they called the Aryan race. The reason it didn't work is because they took too small a pool of candidates to reproduce. And there were all kinds of experiments that nobody talks about anymore, but that the Nazis did to try and mix sometimes with animals or et cetera, or all kinds of genetic experiments which ended up in failure, and trying to generate superhumans for fighting, for warfare. But anyway, okay. But getting back to the archaeological point of view, if there's a worldwide catastrophe and you have little pockets where 1,000 people here or over there, up in the mountains, totally diverse from each other, totally separate from each other, they start to repopulate that area. And by the way, this is what, for example, when the Europeans started growing and Marco Polo found the spice route to the east, they started contacting civilizations that were totally separated for thousands of years after the last great catastrophe. But okay, so let's take 1,000 people. A great example is ancient Greece, where the 1,000 people lived up in the mountains and survived a great worldwide catastrophe, and then they started reproducing, repopulating, and became what we call the ancient Greeks. So they were educated. They had a history. They weren't very clear on what it was, because the ancient Greeks had to go back to Egypt, to the priest cults in Egypt, to ask them what really happened. And even the priest cults in Egypt did not have a good understanding of history. We have a much better understanding now, in hindsight, understanding how these catastrophes happened as large comets, planet-sized objects in the form of a comet came by Earth and devastated planet Earth, leaving very small populations on planet Earth. One of them was the Noah's Flood, where the Earth went through a comet tail for the period of about, what they say, 40 days and 40 nights. To take the population of about 1,000 people. And so what happens is take that 1,000 people and use the power of two. A third world country population growth of 7% per year doubles every 10 years. Go 10 years, doubles, then doubles again. That population doubles after 10 more years. You do that over a period of 100 years, 10 increments of 10 years, 100 years, and you get a multiplication of 1,000. So that means over the first 1,000 years, the first 100 years, that 1,000 people becomes 1,000,000 people. Now you have 1,000,000 people, and that's where the ancient Greeks were. They had a significant population, and they were growing. And then if you go over another 100 years, that 1,000,000 people, number of persons, the number 1,000,000 population becomes 1,000,000,000. And if you go over another 100 years, this is left unabated with this perfect repetition of 1,000 times. Left unabated, that 1,000,000,000 population will become 1,000,000,000,000. That's so in 300 years, you have 1,000 people growing into 1,000,000,000,000 people. But of course, that never happens because there are wars, there's other calamities, there's other difficulties, there's lack of resources, there's all kinds of reasons. and prosperity. So when societies become very prosperous, that third world population model breaks down, and it starts, the population actually starts to go down because people have more money, they have more leisure time, they have more nicer chariots in the old days or nicer cars today. They can go on vacation, so they tend not to get married as soon. They tend to have less kids because the kids are a financial burden, etc. And it's because in a third world country, there's not a lot to do, so the young kids start having kids at age 15. And that's where you get that doubling of population every 10 years, that 7% growth rate. Okay, so at any rate, that's the power of two. And so that's why China, that's why India today have these vast populations, because they got going earlier than, say, the Southwestern American Native Americans, or, say, the even the Europeans didn't get going as fast. There were after the last great catastrophe, which was the Venus event, the Moses event, the Velikovsky event, populations fared much better in India and in China. So they started with a much bigger native residual population than did other parts of the world. So that's why they grew. That's why they have a billion people today. But China, for example, started to, because they were so worried about population growth, they overreacted and started killing all the little girls when they were born. They did, in fact, a lot of the women implemented that locally. But be that as it may, the China's population, they took away all the little girls. So within one generation, you have all these men born. And as I think was John Moore pointed out, that it was a kind of like a social thing where the fathers thought it was important to have a son. So since they could only have one child, they wanted a boy to carry on the family name and tradition, etc. But gee, what happened? Without little girls, there's no more reproduction. There's no more generation of the population. So today in China, you have all these men with no wives. There's no girls. Unbelievable. So the population in China is about to implode. Okay, so I'm going to switch topics just a little bit here, somewhat on the same thing. There was a place named Troy in history, and they've actually discovered it. There was a real place named Troy, and it was destroyed. There was a fight between the Greek nations, and to enter the city, because Troy was a so-called impenetrable city, with great defenses, etc., the enemy built a horse, a giant horse, and set it outside the city. And so the people woke up one morning, and the leaders said, no, don't bring this in, or I don't know how the story came down. But at any rate, they brought the Trojan horse into the city, but of course inside the horse were soldiers whose job it was to kill the guards at the gate and open up the front portal to the city and let the enemy in. And one night they sacked and burned Troy. So that's going on in the United States right now. So the illegal immigration going on right now, which is primarily young males of military age, and when they come across the border, they give them a telephone. That telephone is so they can communicate with them. They also give them money so they can live. They don't have to work. They can go someplace, and in a lot of cases, people are finding places for them to stay. But all they're going to do someday is give them a signal, and they have to report to a certain location, and they could become the Trojan horse that destroys the United States from within. And of course, that is the entire goal. That's been the goal all along. That's the goal of school shootings, of mall shootings, staged events that the outrage that always comes back immediately is, oh, we have to take the guns away from the people. Instead of concentrating on the nutcases. And nobody ever investigates. You've never seen a real investigation of a school shooting or of any of these public shootings. Because the reason is because they take their computers, it simply gets lost. And so the end result is most of the shootings are coordinated. They're planned. There are handlers that handle these nutcases, and they have them all over the place on any given day. It could be in a neighborhood near you, a mall near you, a school near you, a church near you, any place in the United States. And the idea is that after each one, the cry is going to go out that we have to get rid of these guns. And if you have liberally educated doofuses from colleges in the U.S., young boys, young women, who don't know anything and don't understand what's going on, have no clue what the Communist Manifesto is, then they're easy prey. They are easy prey, and so the cry goes out, oh, we have to confiscate guns. What do people need? AK-47, AR-15, what do you need those for? The entire reason for having weapons is to protect people against an incendiary government. That is the entire purpose. It's not for so everybody can go deer hunting. And that's what it has always been. And if you find countries in the world that have fallen overnight, it's because they were not, the population was not armed. Okay, now using this same line of thought, the power of two, the population growth, etc., I once saw a statistic that was very interesting. You take an oak tree or a maple tree or, you know, a tree that in 1 year produces a tremendous number of seeds. And it was something incredible, like, okay, the first year. And this is assuming that this tree is the only tree on the planet, that it has no competition. In other words, when a seed falls from this tree, it will grow and produce another tree. And within a number of years, that tree will be producing seeds, etc. And so it's a very short amount of time, like less than 100 years also, in which an oak tree, if left unabated, with simply its reproduction, and like I say, this is assuming every seed grows and then grows into a tree, so those seeds would have to be distributed. So this is kind of a thought experiment, but and not realistic, but it gives you an idea of the growth of biological isolated, identifiable. I don't want to use the word species. I don't like that word. It's been misused. It's been converted into other meanings. Okay, so anyway, you take the oak tree, and within less than 100 years, this oak tree would repopulate and cover the entire world. And so, and this, again, is assuming that these seeds were planted and spaced properly, because an oak tree takes up a lot of space. And that's one of the issues that, say, over the course of the lifetime in a real situation with an oak tree, it drops how many thousands, tens of thousands of seeds in a year. And in the same with, a maple tree or any other kind of tree, thousands, tens of thousands of seeds in a year. But most of them are eaten by something else. And over the course of the lifetime of that oak tree, probably only one of those seeds actually succeeds in growing, because, say, a seed is germinates under an oak tree, then you have the deer population that comes along and eats it, and other animals can eat it. And as it gets bigger, animals eat the leaves off of it. And finally, this oak tree, this one oak tree, is able to survive this gauntlet of everything, you know, almost an impossible run. Plus, it has to compete with space with other types of trees and other plants. And like out in the prairie, it's very difficult for trees to grow, so you only find a tree every now and then. But anyway, that gives you an idea of growth. Now, recently I've been looking at the statistics of the basically extinction level species. I'm going to have to use that word because we don't really have another one that describes it. But biological entities, let's call them that for lack of a better word, biological entities that are going extinct because of the influence of man. And this comes in all shapes and sizes. You know, every time they want to put in a building or an installation of some kind, there's a frog or a desert toad or a, you know, something. But those are real things because these animals have a small habitat and it's going to be destroyed. Offshore wind, for example, is destroying the habitat of whales, where they come in and they're using sonar, and the sonar bounces off these underwater pillars that they use as a base of the wind turbines, and they get confused and they swim off, they get beached, and then they die, or they cannot find food, things like that. And so the developments that man has made, and a lot of times supposedly in the name of ecology, supposedly green energy, there are devastating effects on the native population. So at any rate, but look at this. In light of the fact that these populations are going extinct, there is hope that these can come back. And coming back is a very difficult thing because you have only those very first few generations where you're starting to gain numbers. It's very difficult to get these living entities into a cycle where they have enough population base where they're going to succeed. And so a lot of times humans are helping them out. They're going out in the field, they're taking the babies, you know, giving them food, etc. But one of the issues is that a wild animal, from the time they're a baby, some of the very first lessons they learn is how to hunt or how to forage for food or whatever their food source. They have to learn that from a very young age. And of course, today humans go in a grocery store and everything is boxes. That's how a human today identifies with food, is boxes on a shelf. You know, nice packaging, beautiful colors, beautiful picture on the cover of a product. And that's how people identify food today. So take the native population of the world today and take them out and give them a survival situation where they have to go out and actually find food in the wild. They wouldn't know what to do. You know, the pioneers, in fact, the Native Americans taught the pioneers how to live, you know, how to plant, etc. And then, you know, because they really didn't know how. They came from, a lot of times in Europe and in England, where the first settlers came from, most of them did not live on farms, and if they did, they didn't have the type of farming implements. They went out in the woods. They had to chop trees down to make a little area to have a garden. It was pretty tough. These people didn't live long. The average life expectancy in the 1700s or the 1600s was maybe around age 30. That's how long people lived. They lived long enough, if they were one of the rare few that had children, and then those children grew up in very difficult conditions. Life was not easy. And by the way, there's this is being discussed more and more on talk show, radio talk show, and other venues, talking about how in the modern age today we have very good, you know, health care. That's why the population is growing, etc. But the power of two shows you that if you had, say, a frog or a fish or a salmon or trout or any other type of indigenous animal that was waning, that its population was waning, and because of forces outside of its control or human influence, let's put it that way, and that's the biggest one, that's the biggest cause of extinction-level events today for the animal kingdom, they can grow back very quickly. When you think that within 100 years, 1,000, a population of 1,000, can grow to 1,000,000, and with another 100 years could grow to 1,000,000,000, you can see that the populations can expand, they can go exponential very quickly. And so that gives one hope, at least for the species that are going extinct, because if man can control himself, and it's simply an issue, for example, water usage, water pollution, and in that sense, the government has allowed industry to pollute the world, pollute the water tables, use too much energy, and the result of using too much energy is the ability to, say, build roads. How many road systems and drainage systems have destroyed native land for animals, where the animals have to move, and then they have to cross roads that are very dangerous? You'll find that in states that have, say, high deer population, that there's a lot of deer killed on the road. And of course, I've hit deer with a car, and it just destroys your car. Or elk, a bigger animal like elk. One time I was actually visiting the Montezuma's caverns. It's down in the American Southwest. And driving back late at night from that visit, and going relatively slow because it was very dark, very difficult to see, and I'm driving probably 45 miles an hour because there you can see the elk standing on the side of the road, and they're crossing the road, etc. And believe me, you don't want to hit an elk. So anyway, come roaring by me are two big SUVs. I was in a rental car. These two big SUVs come roaring by me, probably 80 miles an hour, I would say, really fast. I get up the road a few miles farther. Both those SUVs hit elk, and they were completely destroyed. Those cars were totaled, and I don't know if people were hurt or whatever, my goodness, you hit an elk, a number of thousands of pound animal. And what happens when a car like that hits an elk, the front part of the car hits their legs because they're a tall animal. And then the body of the elk comes back into the driver's seat. And same the way with moose. You have to be very careful if you're in moose country or elk country or deer country. It's called overdriving your headlights. Don't overdrive your headlights. Make sure you can see what's on the road. Because I hit a deer one time, and it took out the right front side of my car. And I was not going that fast. So anyway, sorry I got off track just a little bit there. But my point is that when man has excess energy, and a lot of it, then he can build roads, buildings, develop land, plow under large sections of land, and this changes the natural environment for the animals. And so that puts them under a lot of pressure, and the whole food chain suffers, because if the food, say, of the fox or the coyote, if that diminishes, well, then they're going to suffer because they don't have as much food. It's just simple math. And so if man can stop using energy, stop polluting the water, and get back to a more agrarian lifestyle, but with the cities today, And it would be nearly impossible because, with a population now of 370 million people in the United States and growing by 5 to 10 million every year, I mean, this is total insanity, absolute insanity. Okay, changing gears a little bit here. I'm going to talk about the water filters, and I've just posted a summertime sale. And this is, you can use the coupon code. It's listed on the webpage. In fact, just go to the webpage and you'll see the coupon code there. The webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. That water filters is plural with an S. So jmccwaterfilters.com. And so you can get an extra 10% discount. And there is some already existing sale pricing there. And so this is an additional 10% and, of course, free shipping. And I want to make sure you know about the MR5 Whole House Water Filter, an extremely unique product, nothing like it on the market today, stainless steel container, very high quality. And this removes the toxins, chemicals, etc., for the entire house. In other words, hot and cold water in your house will be filtered. It's like having a clean mountain stream coming into your house. And by the way, it leaves the minerals go through. People go, how can you do that? You leave some things go through and some things don't go through. And it's called targeted filtration or intelligent filtration. It's the way the medium is designed to remove certain things and let other things pass through. So at any rate, once again, the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And remember, also, I have my new book that's out on Amazon. It's called The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. So go to Amazon, and that is selling there right now. And if you want my other books, any of my other books, The Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, the whole laundry list of books, CDs, DVDs, the Recalendar Sun Star Clock, a unique product that's only my invention. You only find it on my webpage. And then the three poster set, all of that on my webpage. The webpage, jmccsci.com. Okay, right now as we speak, there is a volcano going active east of Mexico City called Popocatépetl. And when I was young, I lived in Mexico City, and I lived in the southwest section of the city in an area called Tacubaya. And was in a at that time, high-rise apartment, I think it was six stories high. And anyway, the entire eastern side of the apartment was all windows. And that's where the bedrooms were. So the view out the bedroom window was of the entire city of Mexico City at night. It was pretty amazing. But anyway, off much farther in the distance were the two volcanoes, Popocatépetl and Iztaccíhuatl. And I would wake up in the morning and the sun would be rising over in the east. And I actually had a little calendar that I made a line. So when the sun would come up in the morning, I'd draw a little line with a ruler pointing at the sun. So I had the entire spectrum of directions of the sunrise drawn on my windowsill in my bedroom. But anyway, at that time, those volcanoes were inactive. And so, in fact, there were people, friends of mine, that climbed up the mountain up to Popo and took pictures of the crater from standing up around the crater. And I was not in that good of physical condition. I've played football in high school. You know, I played sports, baseball. But I was always in pretty good condition, but to go up there, you had to be in very, very good condition. I mean, extremely good condition. And so I made it about halfway up the mountain, and I got altitude sickness, which means basically your body just shuts down and you have diarrhea. It's not fun having altitude sickness where you just, you know, your oxygen, and of course you're climbing, so you're breathing hard, it's thin oxygen. It's very difficult on your body. So anyway, that's as far as I got up the side of that mountain. And it's just ash. If you were there, it's just little cinder ashes, little stones of cinder about maybe 1 inch in diameter and smaller. That's the entire side of the mountain is covered with that. So it's also very difficult to climb because when you try and push yourself up with your foot slips. So it's really a difficult climb, but these people made it all the way to the top. And but anyway, I did not. But right now, Popocatepetl is becoming active. Now, recently they've shut down all air traffic to the international airport in Mexico City and other air traffic in the area that would be passing anywhere near, because if that thing goes up and blows, say, a column of smoke up in the air, that ash will shut down a jet engine or a turbine engine. It'll clog it up, and that plane is going to come down. So anyway, that's going on right now, a very dangerous, precarious situation. And, of course, the winds are typically from the east, coming across from the east in Mexico City. So if that blows, it could be a very devastating event for Mexico City. And when the Spanish arrived and basically did in the Aztec culture, those volcanoes have been active and deactivated many times since then. But there were lakes that the Aztecs had built in causeways, and was part of it was for defense, so that if any attacking armies came, they only had very small avenues where they could actually get out to where the emperor was. Okay, so anyway, down below there, when I was living there, which is like the early 1970s, they were still building the subway system. The subway system they had purchased from France. Beautiful, beautiful subway system, and electric motors and electric like big rubber wheels. And when you got in it, it was almost silent. And a beautiful subway system, but they were still digging the tunnels for the subway system, and every now and then they would run into a pyramid or something. So this is like, you know, 60 to 100 feet underground where they're running into this. And of course, they attributed these to the Aztecs. Well, it's no way that these could have been built by the Aztecs, because the Aztec structures were up much higher. So what they were finding was the remnants of much more ancient cities. And I've talked about this before in my show. A friend of mine, a longtime friend, a guy named Mark Gaffney, has written a book. It's called Deep History and the Ages of Man. That's also available on Amazon. And it's a very detailed analysis of pole shifts, is basically what it amounts to. That would be the central theme. But a lot of new evidence has come to light dealing with the data, the kind of data that would indicate that there were pole shifts, and not only that there was a pole shift, this is a physical pole shift. I'm not talking about magnetic pole shifts, which happen literally all the time, probably on average once a month. So I'm not talking about magnetic pole shifts, and which is an electromagnetic situation, because our magnetic field, a very small portion of it is actually related to the geomagnetic field. The vast majority of the magnetic field of Earth is from plasma, but I'm not going to go into that. So what we're talking about, with Mark Gaffney is a physical pole shift where the north pole of Earth, which is the spin axis pole, actually gets thrown and sometimes quite far. And anyway, my pamphlet, my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, and the subsequent pamphlet, Surviving Planet X Passage, is dedicated to that topic. In fact, in the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, I have a diagrams of how a pole shift works for planet Earth. But back to these findings that were being discovered in Mexico City, 100 feet underground. And the reason I'm talking about this is because it corresponds with the fact that Popocatépetl is currently active. And so many, many times throughout history, that volcano has gone off and blanketed the Mexico City area with ash and cinder stones and, you know, everything that comes out of a volcano. And so to build up 60 to 100 feet, who knows how many hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years that those cities may have been there and slowly being covered up to the point where the Aztecs didn't know that they were there. You know, and of course, archaeologists are kind of a brain-dead group of people. They're very limited in scope on what they can say as far as interpretation of what they find. They're very limited. They have to make everything sound normal. It has to fit into this scheme of man being 7,000 years old, evolving from some group of people in Mesopotamia within the last few thousand years, you know, and expanding out and creating all the races of man in that time. You know, it's absurd. It's absolutely could not possibly be true. But that's once these things get into the educational system, whether it's from kindergarten all the way up to PhD level or beyond, or in the news media, then they have to stick with their story. But if you look at the Toltecs, which lived north of Mexico City, a very ancient race. If you look at the Mayans and the Olmecs, which were predated the Mayas, and some of the artifacts that are laying around in the jungle, it's very clear that there were very, very ancient races of people living in what is now Central America, Mexico, Central America, and South America, tens of thousands of years ago, and even longer. So we don't know. There's no way of really knowing who built these. But what's interesting is the architectural type had not changed over tens of thousands of years. So the style of building, this pyramid with a temple on the top, or kind of like the base of a pyramid with a flat section, where they then put religious ceremonial locations. And they were extremely fixated on the heavens. And we know from the few writings that have been passed down to us, for example, from the Mayans, and the Aztecs, for example, picked up on what the Mayans were doing. It was kind of like ancient Greece, for example, and then the Romans picking up the pantheon of Greek gods but changing them around. So the Aztecs would be similar to the Romans and the Maya similar to the Greeks in terms of timeline, where the Mayans were well-established long before the Aztecs. And the Aztecs assimilated the pantheon of gods and the meaning of those gods, including Quetzalcoatl, which was the comet Venus. So the point of all of this is that archaeology, and especially the dating of archaeologists relative to all of just literally everything we see, from the Western civilizations to the Egyptian pyramids to the what you find in China and Taiwan and Thailand and other locations in the Earth, on planet Earth. The dating that has been placed on these is simply incorrect. And unfortunately, there's a new wave of people who are coming along, and they're rightfully saying, oh, no, there's some problems with these dating schemes. But then they come in with their own dating scheme, which is equally incorrect. And so it's out of the frying pan and into the fire, so to speak, relative to archaeology. So instead of these Johnny-come-latelys coming along and putting their own dates down, they should be saying simply that we don't know. We do not have a clear idea of dating, and just leave it at that for the time being. And it kind of drives me crazy because I see on these very popular talk shows like Joe Rogan and some of these, and they have these new wave specialists on there. There's some good ones that are very, very astute, and they're not putting dates on things. They're just saying, hey, what's currently in vogue is not correct. But then there's some other people that come up, and they always are talking about the Younger Dryas period or the time frame about 11,000 years ago, and that's simply not true. I mean, there's definitely something that happened at that point, but what they're trying to do is making the mistake of throwing everything in the kitchen sink into that Younger Dryas time frame, and it's simply not true because now it's very clear that there are at least four major pole shifts in the last 120,000 years. And that's why I've told you to read Mark's book. Also read my book that I mentioned before. Mark's book, once again, is called Deep History and the Ages of Man. And my book is The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. Both of them you can find on Amazon. So once again, go to my webpage, JMCC Water Filters. We have a summertime sale on. And probably the most important thing that you can have in your life is clean water, because the water in the United States is so horrific. And the cost, you know, a few thousand dollars for a water filter that filters all the water in your house and that's going to be there working for you years and years and years down the line, is just something that, the reason I'm doing this is so that people have a product, and there's no other product like this anywhere on the market. I have people that go out searching. They're searching and searching all over for a real product, not a water softener, but a water filter, and they can't find it, and they find my products, and they just are relieved. It's like they found heaven on earth. Once again, jmccwaterfilters.com. And I am out of time again. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.